Welcome to the Philharmonic Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 8:34 British Summer Time. Today is June 3rd. Today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. First, let's have a review of what's been happening this week. This week has generally been characterized by a process of mean reversion for stock markets and Wall Street in particular. Wall Street is finishing out the week down over 1% on the Nasdaq, and perhaps a little bit less than that on the Dow and the S&P. But this week has been characterized by general stock market weakness, but not in a particularly dynamic fashion. There was one downward dynamic on Wall Street this week, which countermanded about 4 days on the upside, but the general tone is of a relatively steady range within the context of a pause, which has turned into a medium-term type corrective phase, and the S&P is still quite a bit above its 200-day moving average. A number of European markets were also relatively weak over the last 5 days, and they are also in processes of mean reversion. The DAX is flirting with the 7,000 area. It finished out the week at 7,109. And the 200-day moving average is around the 7,000 area. So the DAX has probably had one of the sharper reactions in Europe. The FTSE is below 6,000 again. The 6,000 area has been a psychological area of resistance for the FTSE for a while, and it really does need to get above that to indicate that demand is returning to medium-term dominance. This was a troubling week for the Australian stock market. Now, the ASX has been range-bound for much of the last 18 months, and it's currently testing the lower side of what has been the range for much of the last 18 months. There was a period in April, May last year when it had broken below that, and it does need to find support in the current region around the 4,500 area to suggest that demand is returning here at the lower side of this range. Otherwise, the short-term downtrend remains intact, and the capacity for some further testing of underlying trading remains a realistic possibility. Elsewhere in Asia, the Nikkei finished out the week in negative territory, but it's held in the current region for much of the last 3 weeks, and investors continue to digest the economic trouble that Japan is going through and the political paralysis that has been a feature of the Japanese market for quite some time now. The Hang Seng this week finished out the week down 1.3%, not that far off where it started out the week and was relatively volatile in between. But it's another market which has been ranging for a reasonably long time and appears to be in the process of rallying from the lower side of that range. The Shanghai A-share market is right down at its testing the lows from late last year, and really does need to get back above the 3,000 level to suggest that demand is returning beyond the short term. It's paused at the lower side here, and that at least is short-term comfort for the bullish camp. But it really is for the bulls to prove in this environment, and clear upper dynamics sustained for more than a few days would really be required to begin to adopt a more bullish stance in the short term. In the ASEAN region, the vast majority of markets continue to hold in relatively close proximity to their recovery highs and, in some cases, all-time highs. The Indonesian market, which has been a leader throughout, has been particularly steady in the last few weeks. It posted a large downward dynamic about 3 weeks ago, but there hasn't been any follow-through. And while that stab to the downside was a little bit of a warning, the relative strength in the sector has been really quite something to behold, and that hasn't changed at all this week. Now, in the commodity complex, the oil market has been hovering around the $100 area on the West Texas and around $115 or $116 on Brent crude. The oil market and the silver market have some striking similarities. Both have become really quite overextended relative to their 200-day moving averages, silver certainly more so. Both had very large downward dynamics, which capped the advance for the medium term, but they have both found support in the region of their 200-day moving averages and have rallied away from those MAs and appear to be in the process of support building. The oil price is a headwind for the global economy, and that has been priced into a certain extent by the government bond markets. The higher that oil goes, the greater that headwind is going to be for risk assets generally. And oil doesn't show much sign that it is going to break below the 110 level on the Brent crude price at present, in which case an additional risk premium is probably warranted for stock markets generally. In the rest of the commodity complex, gold has finished out the week close to $1,550. It was up at 1545 intraday today. It looked at 1550 yesterday, and it was up 8 on the spot price. So that is a probably one of the more consistent trends in the commodity sector, but also in the precious metal sector. In every big move that gold has had, it's been led in the last almost 10 years by either silver, platinum, or palladium. Silver was unquestionably the leader in the recent rally that we've had. Gold didn't become nearly as overextended as silver had become, and consequently, it hasn't had nearly as large a pullback. When one looks at the last 10 years of gold's price history, the last 30 months have been considerably more consistent than the period of time that went before that. And that tells us that the gap between supply and demand is widening. There are more people are willing to pay higher levels to support gold at this level. That would suggest that at the very minimum, we've moved into the second perception stage, psychological perception stage of the bull market, which is acceptance. So I think everybody accepts at this point that gold is in a secular bull market. And people are beginning to initiate positions because they believe that an upward break is more of a possibility, more of a probability than a possibility. And that is helping to shorten the periods of time that the gold price is going to go sideways for. Gold broke upwards in 2001, 2003, 2005, 2007, 2009, and then 2010, and is holding in the region of its 200, above its 200-day moving average and in close proximity to its high in 2011. On all those odd numbered years that gold had broken upwards, it had broken upwards in September. Then it broke up in September last year, which was a consecutive breakout. The chart pattern has become considerably more consistent, and it's in a period of mean reversion right now and a pause in consolidation. But we're into June, and there is no reason to suspect that the cyclicality of gold's bull market has been interrupted. And given the fact that it has held the majority of its advance and is so remarkably consistent, there's a likelihood that gold is going to break upwards in September, if potentially not even sooner than that. And the relative strength that the gold market has is really quite impressive. Now, I mentioned earlier that gold has been led on the upside by one of the other three precious metals, and at present, platinum has consolidated very steadily. It's held a progression of higher reaction lows. It's found support on successive occasions in the region of the 200-day moving average. It's holding in the region of $1,800, really quite admirably. And it looks primed for an upward break in the short to medium term. In which case, it could be potentially, if gold is going to be led at all, the probably the best candidate for leadership the next time that gold is about to extend its secular bull market is likely to be platinum. Elsewhere in the commodity sector this week, the grains and beans have been somewhat volatile, but both corn and soybeans are well supported by fundamentals and are in the process of consolidating in relatively important levels. The soybean market has held above this $1,400 cent level for the last 5 or 6 months. It's broken the short-term progression of lower rally highs within that range, and it's found support in the region of the 200-day moving average. So, the odds are improving that we're going to see a successful upward break. And corn has perhaps been more volatile, but it's also gone up considerably more than soybeans, and it retested its 2008 high earlier this year. It pulled back sharply. It's regained the majority of that decline. It's held this progression of higher reaction lows. It's held above the 200-day moving average. And provided that progression of higher reaction lows remains intact, then we can continue to give the upside the benefit of the doubt. The copper market has held above the $4 area on the COMEX contract for the last couple of weeks, and it's finishing out the week at 412. This continues to look like a somewhat larger reaction or consolidation above and mostly above and certainly in the region of the $4 area, which had been the previous peak for that lengthy range that began from 2000 and probably mid-2006 onwards. So that's still a constructive chart pattern, and the industrial metals generally have at least found support, some of which had pulled back rather sharply, such as zinc and lead. The coffee market, sugar markets have both found support, and there's a continued high degree of commonality across the commodity sector, particularly in agricultural commodities. Inclement weather in the last 18 months has been quite a factor for investors generally, and that isn't something that has changed this year with hurricanes and floods. Well, tornadoes, sorry, in the USA, floods in Australia, drought in China, and also drought conditions in parts of Europe. And that's 2 years on the trot of pretty dismal crop news. So that's helping to support the agricultural commodities generally. When we look at where government bonds have been trading, the US Treasury market continues to hold around this 125 area. It was stronger today by about a half of a full point. And it's rallied now for about 6 weeks. It's broken the almost year-long progression of lower rally highs. The low that was put in back in March is a low of medium-term significance. We're approaching the end of quantitative easing. There are two ways of looking at that. The first is that the largest buyer is leaving the market, but the largest seller is also leaving the market because with quantitative easing, the supply of bonds will decrease, at least in the short term. And that is helping to support the government bond markets. And the fact that you have had oil holding these high levels for a rather significant period at this point is also putting downward pressure on growth forecasts, and that's also helping to support the government bond prices. However, the supply of bonds over the last 3 and 4 years has exploded, and major bull markets don't generally tend to end because demand has disappeared, but they tend to end when you've had an explosion in supply. In a stock market, when prices go to extraordinary levels, then companies rush out to IPO because they don't think that they're going to be able to get a better price for their company anytime in the near future. To an extent, we're seeing that right now in some of the social media, where the favorable prices achieved by LinkedIn and the strong valuations that have been placed on a company like Facebook have also encouraged other social media sites to attempt to IPO their companies. We saw that in the Nasdaq for stock markets as well, where there was a rash of people rushing out to IPO a business model. In the commodity markets, the last major commodity market and bull market ended when the supply of new raw materials increased considerably as new mines were all opened at the same time. And that helped prices to peak as well. And with the bond markets, such has been the debt that has been accrued by private institutions, particularly in the Eurozone, but and in within the states and in the government in the USA, that there's been an incredible nationalization of private risk, and the supply of sovereign bonds has increased considerably. We've had corporations rushing out to issue extraordinarily long-dated bonds. We've had Mexico issuing 100-year bonds, and that's because they're attempting to lock in the lowest yields, the lowest cost of capital that they've seen in a generation, and in many cases considerably longer than that. So that's a characteristic of a major top in bond markets. And when we look at the chart of treasury yields and see that yields halved in 2008, they went from 4 to 2% in the space of less than 2 months. We're currently in base formation development, and it is really only a question of how long the base is likely to take to be completed rather than whether we're going to get another additional move to the downside. People point to Japan and say that yields can go to zero, and that is certainly the case. But most of Japan's debt is held internally. It's basically the Japanese lending to each other, whereas the majority of the USA's debt is held externally. And it is questionable whether they will be able to find buyers for increasingly large amounts of debt when they're already having trouble finding buyers at today's yields. Commodity price inflation is in the pipeline. We're seeing that a large number of agricultural commodities have broken out of inflation-adjusted downtrends. Industrial commodities did something similar in the last decade, and precious metals did it before that, and oil was one of the first commodities to break out of an inflation-adjusted downtrend. That suggests that raw material prices are no longer going to be going down in inflation-adjusted terms, and that we've entered a new period where commodity prices are likely to sustain higher prices for longer periods of time. The deflationary pressures that were exported from Asia in the last 20 years have also bottomed. Wages are heading higher in China in particular, and we're also seeing that wages are heading higher in a number of other jurisdictions. And with commodity prices also on an upward trajectory, and the standard of living having improved considerably right across Asia, the likelihood that we're going to see a continued flood of low-cost manufactured goods flooding out of Asia and into Western markets and helping to depress prices is really quite low. And that means that whereas China was able to export deflationary pressures to much of the rest of the world for the last 2 decades, it's likely to be exporting inflationary pressures for the next decade. And that is also a challenge in a low growth environment. We are currently in the greatest urbanization in history. We're seeing that hundreds of millions of people are being raised out of poverty and into the middle classes. They're increasingly moving from rural to urban areas. And if one looks at a map of urbanization, and I used a map like that in my presentation to the ATAA and the TAS in April and May, and it shows that Asia is one of the least urbanized places in the world. It also has some of the largest populations, and we're seeing a massive migration. China is certainly well ahead of the game in terms of infrastructure development. They've built roads and railways and airports and houses and power capacity and water treatment facilities, on top of an incredible amount of industrial capacity. And the average Chinese person has seen their standard of living rise remarkably in the last 20 years. And China has been the leader, but India is also turning the corner and is well on the way to raising hundreds of millions of its people out of poverty. And it's a similar process right across the majority of Asia. Governance is everything has long been a mantra at Fuller Money, and it's the countries that have adopted capitalism and have been able to offer a better quality of life for their citizens in return for social cohesion and cooperation in achieving a better life for everyone on aggregate have certainly succeeded. The countries that have equally large young populations but have calcified and are more interested in preserving the status quo rather than adapting and creating a better standard of living and creating jobs and educating their young people are currently running into trouble. And that's likely to remain a pervasive theme, that the countries that adopt capitalism and attempt to increase their productivity and manufacturing bases and move up the value chain in terms of manufacturing are the ones that are likely to succeed. And those countries are predominantly in the Asian region. The rest of the world, the countries that are doing best and the companies that are doing best are providing those Asian growth engines with the things that they need. So commodities and commodity producers remain in secular bull markets, and companies that are leveraged to global growth and leveraged to the needs, demands, and wants of the burgeoning consumer sector and the growing middle classes are outperforming in no uncertain terms. In the early part of this week, I did reviews of US and European shares that were leveraged to global growth and have a strong record of increasing their dividends year on year. And those types of companies have got pricing power. They have well-known, reliable global franchises, and they have almost entirely been some of the leading shares over the last 2.5 years. Leaders tend to lead in both directions, and leaders lead for a reason. And the companies that bottomed first following the 2008 crash were almost universally leveraged to the growth of the global consumer. That's the big story that's helping to drive this bull market. And the process of mean reversion that we have, primarily on stock markets, has not yet run its course. But within the context of relatively consistent medium-term uptrends, reversions to the mean are generally reasonably good buying opportunities. Monetary conditions remain really quite accommodative in the USA, Europe, and Japan. They've tightened somewhat in places like China and India and Australia, and that's where inflationary pressures have been seen first. The benefit of countries in Asia, and the ASEAN region in particular, has been outperforming is because Their pace of economic growth is outstripping the inflationary pressures that are already being noticed by their various economists. And that is helping to support interest in their stock markets. And there is the added bonus for foreign investors that you have interest rate differentials now at levels that were already considered attractive before the financial crisis. I posted earlier this week, I posted a number of interest rate differential spreads between the Australian dollar and other major currencies. And while the absolute levels of interest rates are still quite low, the spread between, for example, the pound and the Australian dollar are at historic highs. And those interest rate differentials are helping to spur investment demand in higher yielding currencies. And the fundamental story of the greatest urbanization in history and the lifting of hundreds of millions of people out of poverty is an inspiring theme, and it's likely to continue to motivate investors for the foreseeable future, although it will obviously be punctuated by medium-term corrections. And perhaps one of the greatest risks there is the high oil price, which remains a concern, and there is no great evidence yet that the oil price is about to turn around in a meaningful way. Now, I think with that, I will leave you for the evening and wish all the best to all of you.